My friends, if I were to tell you that I was giddy as a schoolgirl about the second week of July, first, I'd have to admit that I'm not quite sure what that metaphor means. Second, I guess I'd have to answer the question of why the second weekend in July instead of the first week of July, which everybody knows contains the most important holiday of the year, 4th of July, most important simply because of the one fact that it is the day on which the Nathan's hot dog eating contest takes place, which is reason enough to have a national holiday, not just because it's the United States Independence Day. But no, my friends, only a few short days after the 4th of July, July 8th through 12th of this year, 2014, in New York City, will be Thriller Fest. And if you're not familiar with what Thriller Fest is, well, I confess, I didn't know either. I'd never heard of it before. But what I did find out is that it's the annual conference of the International Thriller Writers, which, having listened as you have been, you probably would understand that Thriller Fest is probably where I'll find all of my cohorts and people who are thinking just like me, people who read the same books I do, who like the same authors I do, and who probably get as excited about this stuff as I do. So I really, really cannot wait for the second week of July. But when I first heard about the Thriller Fest, and understanding that it is in July in New York City, was one of those things of, yeah, it'd be nice to go, but I'll never make it. It's, you know, who really does that? Who books a trip to go all the way across the country for a book convention or something like that? Not me. And what would I do with the kids? And yada, yada, yada. But as I mentioned before, my wife is also an avid reader, and she likes a lot of writers who write the thriller in the thriller genre. And one of her favorite authors is the author Steve Barry, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with, having written a series involving the character Cotton Malone. Well, it turns out that there's an event coming up through the Thriller Fest convention. So first off, to set the preface, in June of this year, a book, an anthology, is coming out called Face Off, which is through the ITW, the International Thriller Writers. And it's basically a bunch of short stories where two authors in the thriller genre pair off their characters to go at each other or to assist each other in solving some sort of crimes. I'm really not sure. But when you talk about authors like Michael Connelly, Dennis Lehane, Peter James, Ian Rankin, Preston and Child, Steve Martini, John Sanford, F. Paul Wilson, John Lesqua, Lee Child, Steve Barry, James Rollins, I mean, you're talking about people who are all over my wife's and my bookshelves. So the idea that these characters or the authors would put their characters up against each other is really something that is unheard of and yet so exciting. I mean, seriously, the Michael Connelly, you know, Harry Bosch going up against Patrick Kenzie from the Dennis Lehane books, the Kenzie Gennaro books, brilliant. Can't wait for it. Comes out just in a few weeks. But because of this book and the wide release of it, as part of the Thriller Fest convention, they're having they're having a banquet in celebration of Face Off. And so Steve Barry, as I mentioned, one of the authors my wife reads, held a contest on his website. And the contest was, or through Facebook, I guess it was. I'm not even sure what the contest was. Did you have to write in a submission? Did you have to, you know, beg and plead and get down on your knees and kiss some feet or whatever it was? But somehow or other, Steve Barry was going to choose one of his fans to join him at his table at the banquet celebrating Face Off. And the reason why is because at this banquet, Steve Barry is also going to be presented with a Silver Bullet Award for 2013. Incidentally, also receiving an award as a thriller master will be Scott Turow, who, you know, I'm obviously a fan of as well. But so anyways, as part of this banquet, he had this contest for a reader of his to join him at his table for the banquet. And my wife, on a whim, just went ahead and said, sure, I'll go ahead and throw my name in, and whatever the contest was, submit an application. And the application, I think, something along the lines of her description of why she should be at the table, she said, and by the way, you know, my husband is a big time fan of a lot of these authors also, but it's okay, he'll stay at home if I win. Well, lo and behold, not only did Steve Barry pick my wife to win the contest, but he also told her to bring me. So, I mean, seriously, this is like, I like Disneyland. This is like the most exciting thing that I can think of, where I'm going to be at a banquet with all of my favorite authors. I mean, we're talking about Dennis Lehane and Michael Connelly and Steve Martini and Preston and Child, and I mean, a whole host of other authors who, you know, their talents alone just simply blow my mind. I'm kind of quelling here. I mean, this is just so exciting. So that's what's coming up in the second week in July. Yes, the hot dog eating contest is the holiday of the year for my, for, you know, as far as I'm concerned. But this is going to be one of the greatest experiences I think I'm really looking forward to. I'm just really excited about it. And not only that, but we've decided that we're going to make a little bit of a trip out of it. We're going to leave the kids at home, and my wife and I are going to spend a couple days in New York, then do the banquet, then do the Thriller Fest convention, and then come home. So it's something that I know she and I are both looking forward to. And so what I decided I was going to do, I felt like if I'm going to be sitting at this guy's table, I should probably read some of his books, right? Because I don't read any of Steve Barry's books. But I obviously know that my wife is a big fan of his and has read many of his books. So I figured that what I should do is I should probably brush up and learn a little bit about his characters, read some of his books, if not all of them, and at least be able to say that I've read his books and talk to him competently about them, instead of just going to the banquet and saying, "Hey, Mr. Barry, thanks for having me. By the way, do you know where Michael Connelly is sitting?" I think that would be a little bit, probably a little bit rude, considering we're a guest at his table. So I decided I'm going to do that. I'm going to brush up. I'm going to read as many of the Steve Barry books as I can. And so what I did was I went ahead and I read the first book in the Cotton Malone series called The Templar Legacy, and we'll talk about that in a second. And then I decided, instead of reading them all in hardcover, because that's what my wife has, all of them in hardcover, I was going to go to the bookstore. I was going to go to a used bookstore and see if I could find them in paperback, because I, you know, they're actually... The book I was reading, The Templar Legacy, is really kind of heavy, and I figured I might as well get them in paperback so that I don't, you know, hurt my arms having to lift them up. And I went to a couple of used bookstores, and I couldn't find any. For whatever reason, there were no Steve Barry books available, and so I decided that I would just go to Barnes & Noble, I'd break down and buy the book in paperback. Now, for those of you who say, just get it on the Kindle, I didn't want to do that. I've experienced in the past sort of a disconnect with the books I've read in Kindle. I feel like there's a separation between myself and really being invested in the plot, invested in the characters, and I wanted to have the tangible experience of reading a book, you know, Steve Barry's book, so I could at least feel like I had a connection to the characters, a connection to the author. So I had said, you know what, I'll spend the $6 or $7 or whatever it is now, $8 or $9 to get the book in paperback. And as I was sitting in the parking lot, just turned off the car to go into Barnes & Noble to get the next few books in the series in paperback, it occurred to me that this Face-Off book has a whole lot of other authors that I've not read before. Yes, there's a lot of authors I have. Obviously, I've read all of Steve Martini, all of Michael Connelly, all of Dennis Lehane, all of Preston and Child, but there were other authors that I'd not read, and I wanted to familiarize myself with the characters of those authors so that when I do read Face Off, and more importantly, if I see these authors at the convention or at the banquet, that I'll be ready, I'll be prepared. And so for like the next 2 months until the convention, I kind of feel like this is my cramming period. Like I got a really big test and I got to cram as much as I can into that 2 months. So I'm really focusing on brushing up on some of these authors. So I decided I was going to get a list of some of the authors that I'd not read before, and I was going to go into the bookstore and check out what books I could find. And so I did. I got three books by three authors that, interestingly enough, two of them I'd never heard of before, but who seemed to have sold a whole ton of books. I got those books. I got another book. I'll tell you about it. And so this is me brushing up and getting ready. So this podcast is basically Thriller Fest 2014, a prep for the convention. I don't really have a title for it. It's just what it is. It's the Thriller Fest episode, whatever it is. Maybe part one. I'll probably do another part two as I read more of these books. But so the first book, obviously, we're going to talk about is The Templar Legacy by Steve Barry, and it's the first Cotton Malone book. Now, Steve Barry had written a few other books before this one, and those three other books, The Amber Room, The Romanov Prophecy, and The Third Secret. I don't think they include the character of Cotton Malone. So I decided I was going to start with this character because Steve Barry's character, Cotton Malone, is going to also be in Face Off. I figured, well, might as well get used to the character now. And now this book, I mentioned it when Phil and I were talking in our last podcast about how the literary community really ebbs and flows. It's got waves and it crashes down. And when the community finds the next best thing, there's a rush of other authors and rush of books that come to that genre that they really flood the market, they oversaturate the market, and then it kind of ends and the literary community finds the next big thing. And we saw that with the techno thriller, the military thriller, The Hunt for Red October, and then all of the submarine novels that came after that. We saw that with the legal thriller genre with the Firm, and then all of the legal thriller books that came after that. And then in the mid-2000s, or the early to mid-2000s, we saw that with the Templar books after the Da Vinci Code came out. And I did look it up. The Da Vinci Code came out in 2003. And as many of you know, that was just a monumental smash hit. I mean, it was just, it was all over the world, just a huge, huge bestseller. And after that, there was this onslaught of Templar books. Steve Barry, Raymond Corey, and I don't even remember who else they were. And I stayed away from the Templar books. Frankly, they weren't interesting to me. They didn't seem to me to be a topic that I really had much of a care about. I was concerned it wasn't going to keep my interest. And I really didn't have a desire to read them. Not least of which was because I'm not really an event book kind of a reader. I used to, when I was younger, when I was 16 or 17 or 18, I would make sure that I was on the tops of the bestseller list. I was reading everything that was number one, and I'd keep on top of those books so that I could always say that I'd read this book or that book. But for whatever reason, the Da Vinci Code, I stayed away from it, and in all the other Templar books as they came out, I equally stayed away from them. So that was one of the reasons why I never read this book, the Steve Barry book, until now. But after I read the Da Vinci Code, and I talked about it in an earlier episode, I really enjoyed it. I mean, it wasn't a good book. I mean, it wasn't a great book, but I enjoyed it. I thought it was fast-paced. I thought the characters moved quickly. I thought the story moved quickly. The story was compelling. And it was tied around this, this murder. And it had, I didn't think that it really let up the tension or let up the speed. It really was kind of a breakneck pace. And I think that also the reading experience that I had with the Da Vinci Code helped to increase my enjoyment of the book, because I did read it with the not the annotated version, the illustrated version, where it had pictures of the places where Robert Langdon and whatever her name was, Sophie or whatever it was, where they went. So I got to see the pictures of the locations that they were, where the events were taking place. So it really helped to bring the story more to life for me. But after having read the Da Vinci Code, it wasn't like I was clamoring to read another Templar book. I liked it. I liked the idea of finding the Holy Grail or whatever it was, denying the existence of Christianity or something like that, because I find it interesting. I've always found the topic of Jesus and the creation of the Christian religion a fascinating topic from the standpoint of, my wife and I have talked about this a lot. I've always, wondered how Christianity came about when you've got Jesus, who was Jewish and lived his life as a Jew and presumably died Jewish. I mean, there was no conversion. He didn't convert to his own religion. And yet hundreds of years later, or however long it was later, there's the creation of this religion based on the belief that Jesus was the Son of God and the Messiah and all this kind of stuff. So I'm very curious about that, and I'm interested in it. But I'm not interested enough to want to read it as a textbook. I'm interested in it if it's if a compelling story is created that is driven by the search for the truth about these things. And the Da Vinci Code did that. I didn't think that I was going to be interested in it, but after having read it, I realized that was something that was interesting to me. It was compelling. But other than that, the Templar stories, I just wasn't sure that they were really going to grab me. And so I read this book not because I wanted to read a Templar book, but because I wanted to read the Steve Barry book. I wanted to read the Cotton Malone book. And what I did when I reviewed it on Goodreads is I called it the very best two-star book I've ever read. And frankly, this is a situation where the failing was not of the authors, the failing was mine. This is just not a topic that I found interesting. This is not a topic that grabbed me, and it was not a topic that really forced me to continue to read into the wee hours of the morning, late at night, and any given moment that I had free. And I think that's just my failing. It's not anything that the author did. The author has a job. The author's job is to take a subject and make it compelling reading. And the author has to understand, I mean, granted, the author's got to understand, that the topic that he chooses is not going to be for everybody. Okay, there are people out there who don't read legal thrillers. There are people out there who only read romance. There are people out there who won't read sci-fi. Whatever it is, the author knows that they're catering to a specific subset of the population, of the reading population, that's going to like their book. And the author did a fantastic job in this book. Well researched, well thought out. The story moved along. I mean, it really wasn't just a short story or writing from the seat of his pants. I mean, you could tell there was a huge amount of research, a huge amount of plotting and creation of the story. The research, I can't really express enough how significant the research was. But it just wasn't my kind of story. It just didn't grab me. I would like to see the character of Cotton Malone as he grows and develops, because you don't really know a lot of his backstory. You know about his the fact that he's retired now and he owns a bookshop in Copenhagen, but he's supposedly a former member of this group called the Magellan Billet, but we don't know what they do. And so the Cotton Malone character is a bit of a mystery, and I'm interested to see how his development continues. It's funny, I will say to my wife when we're watching TV, on the very limited situations in which I do watch TV, I'll say to her at the end of an episode that it always seems like next week's episode is going to be better, because the coming attractions always make it seem like it's going to be this hugely amazing episode, whereas the episode you just saw probably wasn't that great. And it always seems like next week's going to be better. And as I was reading The Templar Legacy, I was going through Goodreads or Amazon, and I was looking to see the rest of the books in the Cotton Malone series. And each of the next books just seems to look like it's going to get better and better and better. And I get that it's going to be all similar to The Templar Legacy. I get that it's going to be, Cotton trying to discover something that is buried in the past, and there's some sort of a scavenger hunt aspect to it, and it's tied to some historical event of significance or whatever it is. I get that. But it seemed like each of the next books, they just seemed like they're getting better and more interesting, more interesting, more interesting. And so the fact that I didn't particularly like this book is not enough to dissuade me from reading the future books, because I think the only reason I didn't like this book as much as I could have is because of the subject. I just not drawn to the Templar story. And the portions of the book that I really did enjoy were some of the historical stuff dealing with the questioning about Christianity from the standpoint of a comparison of the four books, Matthew, Mark, John, and Luke, and how they differ from each other and how they purport to tell the same story but have different facts. That stuff was fascinating. I really, really enjoyed that stuff. But comparing this to the Da Vinci Code, I just found the Da Vinci Code moved faster. It certainly moved more places geographically. I mean, the Da Vinci Code, they were traveling all over Europe. It seemed like in the Templar Legacy, they were really only traveling between or around a couple of different places. And I think that's just my own issues with reading the story was it's just not the kind of book that I gravitate towards. And yeah, there were a couple times where I said, I really should just put this down. It's not my kind of thing. But I'm really a firm believer in, if I'm going to read the series, I want to start at the beginning. And I know in a lot of situations, the first book of the series is just not as strong, that the books get better as time goes on. The author develops a better writing style, or the author develops maybe a tighter storyline. Maybe just the author develops and matures a little bit. A perfect example of that is the Robert Craze books with Elvis Cole. The first book called The Monkey's Raincoat. I didn't think it was that good. I think it was only like 200 pages anyways, but I don't remember being blown away by it. But I liked the character enough, and I liked the idea of the character, his little idiosyncrasies with the Mickey Mouse watch and the Pinocchio clock and things like that. I liked enough of that that I said, I'm going to keep reading. I want to see if the character gets better and the stories get better as time goes on. And in fact, been tremendously rewarded by that, because if you are aware, if you've read any of the Elvis Cole books, it's just a phenomenal character. He and Joe Pike have a great relationship. I love the cynicism and sarcasm that Elvis has, balanced against the warrior type that is Joe Pike, but with the sensitivity. And so that was a situation where the first book didn't really grab me as much, but I pushed through and really was rewarded. And I think that's going to be the same with the Cotton Malone books, and I'm really looking forward to reading more of them. So I do have the second book in the series called The Alexandria Link, I think. And I'm going to pick that up relatively soon after I kind of get through some of the other authors that are on the Thriller Fest / Face Off list. So that was Steve Barry's The Templar Legacy, and yeah, what can I tell you? So what I did was, as I said, I went to Barnes & Noble, and I had written down a couple of other, nobody writes stuff down anymore. I had it on my phone, and I had the Face Off page loaded onto my phone, and when I wanted to find an author, I just clicked to that page, looked at it again, turned my phone on, put it back in my pocket, and went to see if I could find the author. So the next author that I found was an author by the name of Peter James. Now, Peter James is an author I'd never heard of before. And yet, somehow or other, this guy has sold millions of copies of books, and I didn't know it. And that really bothered me. It really bothered me because I like to pride myself on knowing who these people are. I like to pride myself on being in touch with what's new, what's good, what's selling, what people like. And somehow or other, I wasn't aware of Peter James. And the book that I picked up, it actually says around across the top, number one international bestseller. And it's like, I was like, well, how is that possible? How have I not heard of this guy before, that he sold all these books? And it turns out he's got a tremendous library. I don't know, 15, 20, 30 books. I don't even know. I'm not even going to look at it and try and count right now. But I'd never heard of him before. And I did know that in the Face Off book, his character of Roy Grace goes up against, let's see, who's the character? He goes up against Ian Rankin. And if I remember, what's Ian Rankin's character's name? Ian Rankin's character's name is not coming to me right now. And I know I read one of them. Why can I not remember? Okay, I'm going to pause and Google. Here we go. Ian Rankin's character is John Rebus. And I read one of Ian Rankin's books. I read the first book. The first book was called, I think, Knots and Crosses. And I didn't really like it that much. I'm sorry. I know he's a huge, huge bestseller, a best-selling author. I know that there's been a lot about his retirement and something about ending the series, but I didn't really like it that much, and I'm going to tell you why. I didn't like the Ian Rankin, John Rebus book because, to me, he seemed somewhat of a stereotypical police detective who shows up in detective stories. Broken marriage, alcoholic, you know, butts against heads with his superiors. And I didn't think that the book itself was really that compelling. And this is one where I opted not to follow my own sometimes suggestion, which is disregard the first book in the series and plow through because they get better. And I'm sure they do. I think I had this with the Harry Hooley books by Joe Nesbo, which we talked about a while ago, that push through them, they start to get better, yada yada. And in fact, I think I recall quite a lot of similarities between Harry Hooley and John Rebus. But for whatever it was, I did pick up the second book in the series. I haven't read it yet, and I'm not sure if I will. You know, sometimes you look at a series of books and you say, if I'm going to pick up this book, the first in the series, and there's, you know, 13 books in the series, I've got to be ready to commit. I mean, that's fair. I think if I pick up the first book and I like it, I've got to be ready to commit to it. And I certainly did that with the Lee Child books when I picked up Killing Floor, and I knew there were something like 15 or 16 other Jack Reacher books out there. I knew when I was picking up that book that if I liked it, I was ready to commit to read the series. And with the John Rebus books, I was picking up the book knowing that if I liked it, I was ready to commit to the series, but I didn't like it enough to say, I'm ready to commit. And so I opted not to read any more of them, and I decided I was going to go find something else. With the Cotton Malone books, I picked it up knowing I'm ready to commit to the series, and I am ready to commit to the series. I'm ready to go. So with these other books that I'm picking up in preparation for Thriller Fest, I'm not picking them up with the idea that I'm going to be ready to commit to the series if they are books where there's characters that are part of the series. I'm more picking them up with the idea that I want to familiarize myself with the character, so when I read Face Off, I think I'll enjoy it more, and that if I meet any of these people or see them at Thriller Fest, I can speak competently about their writing and about the characters. But if it turns out that it is a series and I pick up the book and I like it, I'm ready to commit to the series. I hadn't really gotten to that point with Peter James, and it's my own failing because I kind of disregarded my own rule. When I picked up Dead Like You by Peter James, I didn't realize, or for whatever it was, I wasn't thinking, this is not the first book in the series involving his character Roy Grace. This is maybe even the sixth or seventh book in the series. Sixth book in the series. Okay. So it didn't even occur to me. I don't know why. I'm usually right on top of this. When I pick up a book, I know that it's not the first book in the series. I'm putting it back. But for whatever reason, this particular book, I picked it up, didn't realize it wasn't the first in the series, but it had enough of a draw. The back cover of the book was enough to draw me in that I said, I'm ready to read it. And man, was this book outstanding. I mean, it was awesome. I don't consider right or wrong. When I think of a thriller, I think of a mystery, I think of a murder. It seems to be pretty typical. You look around the bookstores, especially in the mystery thriller section, you're going to see a lot of murders. And in fact, you look at the list of the Face-Off authors, they all write about murder. And yet this book, Dead Like You, isn't really about murder, it's about rape. And I picked up the book and I looked at it and I said, wow, rape, that's one I haven't seen a lot of before. I just don't recall a lot of books that I've read that involve rape. For whatever reason, call me very simple-minded, it seems to me like rapes should be more easy to solve because there's DNA or there's visual evidence, and if the victim isn't killed, then there's eyewitness testimony and things like that. So I don't have a lot of experience with rape. And this one seemed to me to be a great place to start. I've had some negative. I've had some reading experiences that were not really good with authors who are British, especially when they write contemporary. The British authors who write Victorian thrillers, I've had no problem with. I've typically enjoyed them. But the authors who write contemporary fiction, who are British, who write contemporary mysteries, for whatever reason, I haven't really been able to kind of connect to them, whether the writing style is different, whether there's a coldness to it. You know, I'm thinking about people like P.D. James and Elizabeth George. I haven't really felt as much of a draw to those authors and to the contemporary mystery that takes place in the UK. So I was a little nervous about Dead Like You by Peter James. And wow, whatever concerns I had or hesitations were pretty much blown away after the first chapter, and it just went from there. I mean, I could not put the book down. One of the things I liked about the book, and it's just a style thing, I like when a book has short chapters. I really do, because it to me, it feels like the book moves. And this book actually bounced back and forth between times. It bounced between now and 1997 when crime was committed, and our main character Roy Grace is wondering if the crime from 1997 is connected to the crimes that are happening now. And one of the things that I can say, having picked up the book in the middle of a series and not realizing it was a series, is my mind immediately starts to believe, you know, starts to try and put stories together. I start to put characters together. I start to put the mystery together. And one of the deals is that Roy's wife has been missing for many, many years. Nobody knows what happened. The investigation has been going on. And in fact, the investigation came to a stall because, frankly, there was no evidence of what happened to her. She could have run away. She could have gotten killed. She could have gotten kidnapped. Nobody knows. And so when I hear about that, or when I read about that in the 1997, we find out, I did not know this already, obviously, I find out that his wife is 7 years or 8 years missing, or whatever it was, my immediate thought is, oh, it must have something to do with the crime that was committed in 1997. It must have something to do with that. It's the rapist, it's the murderer, whatever it was. That's where the connection's going to be made, that the author's going to bring it all back together. And then as I realized through some other research that this was actually the fifth book or sixth book in the series, it occurred to me that it's probably not going to resolve itself with the wife by the end of this book. And in fact, it doesn't resolve itself. Incidentally, I was listening to another podcast with a friend of mine called Speaking of Mysteries, and the one of the hosts is Les Klinger, who's a friend of mine. And they interviewed Peter James at the LA Times Festival of Books. This is a weird, bizarre coincidence that I'm reading Dead Like You as I'm listening to the podcast. And they make mention of the fact that Roy Grace's wife has still not been found, and is there a resolution to that mystery coming? So, at that point, I was still halfway through this book, and I realized, okay, her disappearance has nothing to do with the crime from 1997 that Grace was investigating, or that the current day crimes that he's still investigating. So that was a little bit of my own poor planning not to have gotten the first book in the series. Although I will say that after I finished this book, I did buy the first two books in the series. I found them used on Amazon, and I got one of them. I think it cost me $4.57, and that was $4.50 for shipping and 2 cents for the book. So really looking forward to reading those books. And this is one where, after having read Dead Like You and know it's a 8 or 9 book series so far, I'm committed to this series because I really like the character. Roy Grace was not typical of the Harry Hooley or John Rebus. He's not the drunk. He's not the broken down, doesn't get along with the supervisors, no family, whatever it is, estranged from his wife, estranged from his kids, nothing like that. It seems like Grace has actually got it all pretty much together. He's got a new fiance, they're pregnant, and he seems to get along well with people. He seems to get along with his superiors pretty well. I will find out as I read the back catalog and then go forward if that stays the same. But I really liked the character, and I really liked the story. I thought it moved quick. There were enough roads that the author was taking us on that could be or could not be. The culprit, I thought he drew all of them back together really, really well, and I'm just really looking forward to this character. So that was Dead Like You. I could give you more about the story, but frankly, I don't want to really, give up any of the story to you. I can tell you that for a mystery novel, which mysteries are typically you know, 300 to 400 pages. There's really not a lot of ways that the author can drag the story out. This one was 550 pages long, and I devoured it. I devoured it. One more chapter. I can do one more chapter. And then you look and it's 12 o'clock at night and it's time to go to bed. So you got to get up in the morning. Yeah, this one, I liked it. I liked it a lot. And that's why I gave it 5 stars on Goodreads, because I liked it that much and I really liked the character. And look, it didn't hurt that as soon as I started reading the author, I found him on Twitter. I decided I was going to follow him. I followed him. He immediately followed me back. And then I tweeted at him and I said, I'm looking forward to Thriller Fest in July. Hope I get a chance to meet you. And he immediately wrote back and said, likewise. So, I mean, come on. This guy's an international bestseller. He's written however many books it is. And in the Roy Gray series, there's, 8 or 9 books, if not more. And he's written a whole bunch of other books that are not part of this series. So, I mean, this is a guy who clearly has got other things he could be doing. And he's tweeting me back, you know, looking forward to meet me. Well, you know what? I'm going to take him up on it. I absolutely will. I mean, that's one of the reasons I'm going, is I want to rub elbows with, you know, not my heroes, but with the people of whom I am a particular fan. And I hope to have read more of the Peter James and Roy Grace novels by the time the convention takes place. So the next book I got while I was at the bookstore was obviously another author that is going to figure prominently in the Face-Off book. His name is F. Paul Wilson. And if you're not familiar with F. Paul Wilson, maybe you're familiar with his character, who goes by the name of Repairman Jack. I've never read a Repairman Jack novel before, although I've been well aware of Repairman Jack for many, many years. And I just never got around to reading it. Now, the Repairman Jack, his story in Face-Off, he goes up against a character from the books written by Heather Graham. And I've never read any of Heather Graham's books. I don't know anything about her. And, I'm going to try and read as many of these authors as I can who are part of the Face-Off book prior to the convention. But, gosh, it's so hard to read women authors. I'm sorry. I mean, we talked about it before. I probably will. I mean, I'm a commitment to doing so. I hear the female author and I kind of get a little antsy, like, it's going to be a chick book, even though they're mysteries. I'll probably pick up a Heather Graham book and get an idea of who her author is, character is, and how she and Repairman Jack are going to tangle in Face-Off. But I've actually picked up and put back F. Paul Wilson books many, many years in the as time has gone by. And I've never actually bought one. And the reason why is, frankly, because I was always a little bit scared. I didn't know enough about the character. I had done some research and knew there was a little bit of a supernatural aspect to the books, like there was ghosts or goblins or something like that. And so I was never really sure what to expect. In fact, I kind of got Repairman Jack and Jack Reacher confused at one point, because when my friend had recommended that I read the Lee Child books, and it says character Jack Reacher, I went, oh, is that Repairman Jack? And he didn't know who I was talking about. But nevertheless, this one I knew, obviously, that there was a series of books for Repairman Jack, and I made sure that I picked up the very first book, which is called The Tomb. And I think this is a reprint, because I think, according to the copyright, it says that it was copywritten in 1984 and then in 2004, and that this is a revised edition previously published in 2004 under the name Rakoshi, R-A-K-O-S-H-I. And that Rakoshi, you know, figures prominently into the book, which would make more sense after you've read it as to why the book was called that. Why the book was called The Tomb, though, I'm really not that sure. It doesn't make it that obvious. I mean, you kind of got to think about it. But anyways, Repairman Jack has a lot of similarities, I think, to Jack Reacher. He's off the grid. Jack Reacher, you know, he operates only by money orders. He doesn't have a home. He's constantly drifting. Repairman Jack, he does have a home, but he rents. He runs under a pseudonym, an alias, I think is the right word. He has no bank accounts. He has a driver's license under an alias. He has no social security number. He has nothing that anybody would be able to find him. And so that's his method of kind of disappearing. And he's a fixer. I mean, he basically, if I could, you know, utilize the, you know, he kind of a private investigator, I guess. He solves problems for people. He finds things, although kidnapping is the subject of this book, and that's not really, I think, what he says is his forte, but he fixes things. And typically it'll resort to violence, resort to death or killing, whatever it is. But this is one where the book starts and we're kind of in the middle of the story. You know, Repairman Jack had been in a relationship with a woman named Gia. They broke it off because she found out what he did. He's kind of still struggling with that. I don't get the feeling from Repairman Jack that he's got a history of, the character of Batman. Batman, as referenced in the first movie with Christian Bale, Batman Begins, he trains, he becomes Batman, he studies and he does all this kind of stuff to get ready to be the superhero. I didn't learn from this book that Repairman Jack did that. I didn't get the feeling that he was a master of weaponry or that he was a skilled in the art of kung fu or karate or jiu-jitsu or whatever it was. I didn't get the feeling that he was of such imposing stature and size, because in fact I think he's like 5'10". So whereas like a Jack Reacher character, you learn that Jack is a former military police officer, and so he's had the military training, and a lot of the analysis and investigative skills that he uses in the books are a product of his background as this MP. Repairman Jack, we find out he dropped out of college, and I guess he just kind of created himself. And so that, I would hope that as the books go along, you learn a little bit more about Repairman Jack and his history, because it's okay to create a character who is a mystery or is an enigma. But as time goes on, I hope that in order to develop more of a connection to the character, the author brings the readers more into how the character came about and where he came from. You don't get a lot of that in this book. Anyways, the subject of the book, or the subject, the mystery is Jack's former girlfriend Gia is very close with her aunt's in-law, I guess is what it is. It's her former husband's aunt's. And one of them goes missing, and it's unexplained how she was seemingly abducted, although they don't know what happened to her. Because she's on like the third story of her apartment building, and no windows are broken, and she didn't jump out and die, and she didn't leave the house because the alarm was set. And so it's all unclear as to what happened and how she, where she went. She just sort of disappeared. And the story kind of takes a weird turn from there. It does involve a little bit of supernatural phenomenon to it. There's a creation of some these things called the Rokoshi, which are like, I don't even know how to describe it. They're half human, half mythical creatures that do the bidding of this Indian conductor who basically has them do his bidding. All sourced from, the events that took place in the 1870s. I think it was the 1870s in Bangladesh, where this guy in the British Army goes and decides he finds it's in West Bengal, India, 1857. This Captain Westfallen, he goes to this. I guess that's where the name of the book comes. This tomb, but I don't think it's a tomb. It was like a cave. And steals all of the riches and jewels that were being housed there by the Indian community. And as he's leaving, and after he's killed all of these other people in the cave, he is cursed by the Indian people there. And this curse is that his family will, the Westfallen name, all of his people will die horrible, tragic deaths. And we find out that Gia's aunts, both of them are Westfallens, that the source of the Westfallen fortune is the jewels and riches that were stolen in the 1850s by Captain Westfallen. And anyways, this Indian who's a descendant, in air quotes, of the people who were killed in this massacre, they've decided that they're going to fulfill the curse and basically blot out the Westfallen name. So that's, in a nutshell, the story of the tomb. Somehow, Repairman Jack is obviously summoned by Gia to search for her aunt. He tells her that this is not his name, but he still investigates anyways, and he eventually tracks down what happened and goes to war, basically, with these supernatural Rokoshi things, and ends up saving the day. So as I was reading, I wondered if this isn't a derivation of The Moonstone by Wilkie Collins. And I know I've talked about it in the past, although I don't think I gave it a whole lot of explanation. But The Moonstone was a story, mystery. Actually, I think the first credited first detective story written in modern times. And it involves this moonstone, this gem, this jewel, that was stolen from some Indians and was given to this gentleman's daughter, and then the moonstone goes missing, and there's this search investigation as to where the moonstone went. And I don't remember a whole lot more about the story than that, other than the fact that I believe it was told from like 15 or 16 different points of view. It was really quite inventive, the way that Wilkie Collins told the story. But I was thinking, I was reading this book, this moonstone thing, I wonder if that, is this book derived from that? Is that something like, maybe F. Paul Wilson read The Moonstone and thought, wow, what if that moonstone, what if that had some supernatural value? Maybe there was something about this. And the reason why I said that is because Repairman Jack, as he's brought into the story, not only is he brought in to look for Gia's aunt, at the same time, on a completely, we believe, unrelated and separate investigation, he is brought in to find a missing necklace. And the necklace was taken off of an old lady as she was mugged on the streets of New York. And we later find out that the person who, I don't want to give away the story, but anyways, this necklace had some significant import as it related to the existence of these Rokoshi. And so I was wondering, as I'm reading that aspect of it, this necklace, what if that necklace was the moonstone? And the reason why the moonstone was so valuable is because it warded off the evils that were these Rokoshi. And not only that, it had a it had an effect of basically perpetual life, the fountain of youth. The people who wore this necklace, they never got old, they didn't feel pain. When they took the necklace off, they rapidly aged to get to their real age, but then they put the necklace back on and they became younger and you know, maintained their youth. So I was wondering if that was something like, maybe he was reading The Moonstone, F. Paul Wilson, and said, wow, what if I took this portion of the story, The Moonstone, what if I took the necklace and I made the necklace kind of my centerpiece for my novel? And I said, okay, so now in the Moonstone, everybody's been searching for the Moonstone, but there's nothing really discussed about why it's valuable, other than maybe it's worth something, but it was handed down from generation. But maybe there's something about the Moonstone that I can now kind of create a whole other mystery around. So if I see F. Paul Wilson at the banquet at Thriller Fest, or I run into him, I'm going to ask him. I mean, why not, right? I mean, this is just me talking. This is me just thinking out loud. Yeah, I'm going to ask him. So as I mentioned, with some of these books, when I know that they're part of a series, I know that if I like it, I'm committing to the series. And for Repairman Jack, I'm not sure. I found that I couldn't get into the book very well. It seemed to take too long to grab me. Usually I can read a book in about a week, and I read this book in about a week, but I was only halfway through the book by Friday, and that's 5 days into reading. And so over Saturday and actually Friday night and Saturday is when I read the other 200 pages of the book. So it took me a long time to get through that first 200 pages. And yeah, it was an interesting book, and yeah, I was intrigued by it, but at the same time, I didn't feel pushed to read it. I didn't feel like, you know, I think one day I read 7 pages. And it wasn't like I was putting the book down because I really wanted to read more and I had to go to bed. It was kind of like, all right, I don't need to read any more tonight. I'll put it away. So this one, I think what I'll do is I'm going to pick up the second book. I'm going to pass this book off as, like I said, the first book in the series that is a little bit of growing pains and maybe is establishing the character. I'm curious if the 2004 version was actually, how much of it was revised from the original 1984 version. Is that what it was? Whatever it was, whenever it was first written. So I'm curious, yeah, 1984, so 20 years later, how much of the book was changed. But I think I'll pick up a second book and just get another feel for it. I am a little nervous that they're going to start getting scary. And it turns out that the Repairman Jack books are they're all over the place. This guy has written so many books all around this, I don't even know, adversary cycle is what he calls. And some of them are Repairman Jack books. Some of them are young adult Repairman Jack books. It's really kind of strange to me how they all work. And I'm not even sure that, I mean, to get through a Repairman Jack, and I think 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, you're looking at 13 or 14 books, plus any of these other books in the adversary circle, which seem to be at least 20 other books. It seems like I'd be making a really, really big commitment if I wanted to get into the Repairman Jack book. So I might pick up another one just to see how it goes. But I'm thinking that if I got to pick and choose which series of books I'm going to start in and really make a commitment to, it's going to be the Steve Barry and the Peter James books and probably not the Repairman Jack books. So the last book that I picked up at the bookstore as part of my commitment to read and prepare for Thriller Fest was a book called Too Close to Home by Linwood Barclay. And I'd never heard of this guy either. I mean, how is it possible? How is it possible that I've never heard of these authors? I mean, these guys have 5, 6, 7, 10 books and I've never heard of them. But Linwood Barclay also is part of the Face-Off story. He goes up against Raymond Corey, whoever Raymond Corey's character is, and Raymond Corey also wrote Templar books, so I know that my wife has read a lot of his books and knows about that character. But I couldn't really find that Linwood Barclay wrote a lot of books in a series. In fact, I couldn't figure that he wrote any books that were series. I think they were all standalones. So not really being sure who the character was that's going to be appearing in Face Off, I just picked up the Linwood Barclay book that I thought looked interesting, which is this book, Too Close to Home. And I just started it today. I'm only about 3 or 4 pages in. And again, we're talking about a mystery or thriller that's 500 pages long, so I'm interested to see how the author is able to draw out the tension and the intensity of it over a longer period of time. Because I think that's what a lot of mystery or thriller authors struggle with. It's easy to do, or easy, this is not the right word. It's common for like a family saga book to really span hundreds and hundreds of pages, 500, 600, 700 pages. And even some of the geopolitical stuff like that Tom Clancy wrote, you can see with as complex of a storylines that dragging it out over hundreds and hundreds of pages made sense. But the mysteries and thrillers, I think that the author has a challenge of really sustaining the level of intensity and tension over 300, 400, 500, 600 pages. Peter James did a fantastic job over 550 pages. I mean, the fact that the books bounce back and forth and fast chapters and a lot of characters and a lot of crimes, that really kept the tension going for the long haul. So I'm interested to see how Linwood Barclay does with Too Close to Home. The idea is that neighbors down the street, husband and wife and son, the son's I think 17 years old, they're all murdered in their house. And that's about as far as I've gotten. So next time, we'll talk about that. I did end up buying, like I said, the first two books in the Peter James book, Roy Grace series. I did buy the next book in the Cotton Malone series called The Alexandria something. Don't remember what it was called. The Alexandria something. I bought another book by Linwood Barclay. I don't remember offhand what it is. I bought it used. So lots more to read. I've got two more months to really cram in as much of these authors as I can so that I can speak competently with them if I have the chance to talk to them. I'm just jazzed about all this. So this is Rob Cohen for Book Therapy. Thanks a lot for listening as well. I've gotten some great feedback from some of you, some of the authors who I talk about. I really appreciate when they write back and tell me that they enjoy the podcast. Vaughn Entwistle, who wrote the Revenant of Thraxton Hall, he liked the podcast. I've gotten retweets out of publishers. I've gotten retweets from other authors, so I really appreciate that. Please email me at booktherapy13@gmail.com. Rate the podcast if you like it. I've gotten even people who have seen that I record a podcast, and I got one person sent me an email through Goodreads that said that they listened to my podcast about Life After Life by Kate Atkinson, and they were so happy that I'd given my review because they as well couldn't figure out what was so great about the book, and they appreciated the fact that I came right out and said that I didn't like it. So to that person, if you're listening again, I really appreciated your email. Please find me, BookTherapy13, on Twitter, and this is Rob Cohen. Thank you for letting me lie on your couch.